Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. We are now beginning our study of the book of Joshua. We've just left Moses on the plains of Moab giving his farewell speech. And some editor of the book of Deuteronomy in the last chapter has Moses safely buried, and now Joshua is taking over. So we start now with Joshua 1, verses 1 through 2. Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Now before we get into verses 1 and 2, let's look at some introductory material. First of all, who wrote this and when did he write it? Well, the Talmud, the Jewish literature, said that Joshua wrote it, except for the part at the end concerning Joshua's funeral. Obviously, he didn't write that. Talmud said that Eliezer wrote the end part concerning Joshua's funeral. Well, I looked at some modern evangelical scholars. There is some disagreement on this. First of all, and the reasons for that are, first of all, that Joshua contains references to early events which support Joshua writing the book. For example, in Joshua 5:6, the pronoun us is used. Joshua 5:6, last half of the verse, says this, So the Lord vowed never to let them see the land he had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Well, I don't really see the force of the argument, because if an editor is writing that, or somebody else, not an editor, excuse me, some other author besides Joshua, he would be Jewish too, right? And he would be included in the us, and so the oath from the Lord would be to him also as well as Joshua. So I don't really see that as a big argument that Joshua wrote the book. There are also references that don't sound like Joshua wrote it. This is from the International Bible Society. For example, the sun still at Ajalon, when that happened, it was said to be written in the book of Jasher. Well, a miracle contemporaneous with Joshua would only have been recorded by Joshua. There would not have been enough time for another author to record it, and then Joshua to get the book of Jasher and say, oh, look at this miracle here, I'm going to write it down. He would just directly say it instead of saying it was recorded in the book of Jasher. And also there are references in the book, 12 of them to be exact, where this phrase, till this day, is used. And such and such has not happened till this day. Well, that sounds like somebody later on in time is writing. So how do we summarize this? Let me summarize this from the Biblica.com website by the International Bible Society. Quote, It seems safe to conclude that the book draws on early sources. It may date from the beginning of the monarchy, which of course is after Joshua, after Judges, before we get to the monarchy. Some think that Samuel may have had a hand in shaping or compiling the materials of the book, but in fact, we are unsure who the final author or editor was, so we'll just leave it there. We don't know. Let me give you the quotes from gotquestions.org, another very good website. Quote, The book of Joshua does not explicitly name its author. More than likely, Joshua, the son of Nun, the successor of Moses as leader over Israel, penned much of this book. The latter part of the book was written by at least one other person after the death of Joshua. It is also possible that several sections were edited or compiled following Joshua's death. Got Questions dates the book at somewhere between 1400 and 1370 BC. And as a note here, the traditional date, or a traditional date for the crossing of the Jordan River, is 1406 BC, because the early date for the Exodus is 1446 BC, and 40 years traveling, leaving Egypt, getting to the Jordan River was 40 years, and so therefore you get 1406 BC. That date I obtained from BibleJourney.org website. So with that background, let's begin our study of the book of Joshua, chapter 1. Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord. After the death of Moses, this is probably after the 30 days during which the Israelites mourned for Moses, which we read about in Deuteronomy 34:8, the last chapter. The Israelites wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses came to an end. Now, the death of Moses happened just before this, and so it makes some commentators believe that the book of Joshua is just immediately connected to the book of Deuteronomy, even with scrolls. Here's what John Gill says, quote, The book begins as if something went before, it is connected with, And indeed, it seems to be the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, which treats of the death of Moses. And Joshua, being the penman of Deuteronomy, as say the Talmudist, I've already mentioned that, and of this book Joshua, as has been seen, having wrote them, he goes on with the journey of his own affairs in strict connection with that account, beginning where that ended, namely at the death of Moses. Some people even say Joshua wrote Deuteronomy 34 and recorded the death of Moses because it fits so nicely in with Joshua. So we don't skip a beat going from the death of Moses to Joshua taking over. Now, Moses in verse 1 here in Joshua 1 is called the servant of God, or the servant of the Lord, Yahweh. Now, Adam Clark says about that, quote, "The word servant, as applied both to Moses and Joshua, is to be understood in a very peculiar sense. It signifies God's prime minister, the person by whom he issued his orders and by whom he accomplished all his purposes and designs. No person ever bore this title in the like sense but the Redeemer of mankind," i.e. Jesus, "of whom Moses and Joshua were types." So when we see that word servant, it's not just an ordinary servant. I just kind of skipped over it when I read it. But it means, man, the servant of God, the prime minister of God. In fact, Jesus was called the suffering servant, if you recall, in Isaiah. And so when Moses is called the servant of God, that's a big deal. That's an honorific title. So after Moses' death, in verse 1 here in Joshua 1, the Lord spoke to Joshua. How did he speak? Well, again, whenever you see that speak, you don't know. Is it in a dream? Is it in a vision? Is it an articulate voice in the sanctuary, the tent of meeting? Is it through the Urim and Thummim? We don't know, but somehow God communicated. He's a personal God. He communicates. He spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun. Now let's look at the name Joshua. His original name was Hoshea. In Numbers 13:8, we see Hoshea, the son of Nun, from the tribe of Ephraim, listed. Now, Hoshea means salvation. Joshua means God's salvation. So his name now has got God in the title. So we are clear now that the salvation does not come from any human agency. It rather comes from God himself. So God spoke to Joshua and said, "Moses, my servant, is dead." Well, of course, Joshua already knew that, but God is just saying that because, hey, since Moses is dead, Israel needs a new leader, and that leader is going to be you, Joshua. Now, note the text doesn't euphemize the bad news like we do. This is my observation. He's dead, Joshua. He's dead. We don't say that. We say he's passed away. He's gone on to his reward. He shuffled off his mortal coil. We come up with all kinds of euphemism because we don't like to talk about death. But as C.S. Lewis once said, death is not a big deal to God like it is to us. He looks down there and says, okay, you're going through a door. Big deal. Ooh, I wish I could have that attitude. I think Christians should have that attitude. I just heard a talk from a man who just lost his twin brother to COVID, and he gets up and he speaks. He's an elder in my church, and he quotes Malachi 4 about the Son of Righteousness, the S-U-N, Son of Righteousness, rising in, like a calf coming from the stall, and how happy we are. And he says, and he showed a video of the calf, a calf let out of his stall for the first time, I think, and he just runs all over the place, hopping and bouncing around. And he said, my brother is bouncing around, leaping in heaven right now. And that's a whole different way of looking at death. And this was a personal thing, as it was his twin brother, and he's in his 50s. Now God says to Joshua, rise, cross this Jordan. Now, crossing the Jordan River is a standard type of crossing from death into life. I remember when Stonewall Jackson was dying at Gurney Station, and he had a vision of the afterlife that was to come. And he says, come, let us cross on over the river and rest in the shade of the trees on the other side. A famous quote if you're into American War Between the States history. So this type has been used a lot. Adam Gill says, quote, as this land was a type of heaven, Canaan was a type of heaven and eternal life, which is the free gift of God through Christ, passing over the river of Jordan to it may be an emblem of the passage through death to the heavenly state, both of the death of Christ, the antitypical Joshua, who passed through it as a surety to make satisfaction for sin, and as a forerunner to set an example, to sanctify death, to open a way into the holiest of holies, and prepare a place for his people, and of the death of the saints, which is necessary to the enjoyment of perfect rest and happiness. And by the way, Joshua, I didn't mention this earlier, Joshua is the same name as Jesus, except it's in Hebrew instead of Greek. And it means God's salvation. Jesus means God's salvation. So Joshua, even in his name, is the perfect type of Christ, the antitype. And Jesus takes us into life, into heaven, if you will, and Joshua took the Old Testament Jews into the Promised Land. The rest, as it was stated in Hebrews 4, the rest of God. In a previous audio, we looked at Moses looking out over the Promised Land, and someone suggested, a commentator suggested, that this is a type of a believer looking at heaven coming up, or the final state, the eternal state coming up before he dies. He can see it, but he can't get there. He's got to cross over the Jordan. He's got to die first, and then he gets into the Promised Land. Now notice in verse 2, the Lord says to Joshua, I am giving this land to all the people of Israel, to the sons of Israel. I am giving it to them. Now, of course, skeptics who hate God, maybe not explicitly, but by their actions and their thoughts, they say, oh, this is terrible. How could the Jews go in there and commit genocide and steal the land and all that? How is it moral to attack and seize someone else's land? Well, because these people deserved it, folks. They had been sinning so grossly. I mean, they'd been sacrificing their children, amongst other horrible things. And the cup of their iniquity had been filled up, and it was taken away from them as judgment. God has the right to do that. He's God. As John Gill says, quote, it could be no case of conscience with Joshua to go and take it out of the hands of the present inhabitants, since the Lord, who had a right to dispose of it, gave it to them. Now, I realize that's a big apologetics issue, and we could spend forever going over that, but I'll just mention it here in case you want to do some more work on that, in case it bothers you that those poor, innocent Canaanites had their land taken away from them by those nasty Jews. We go now to Joshua, verse 3. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, Yahweh continues to tell Joshua, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. Now, every place on which the sole of your foot treads, that's a phrase that was given by God to Moses in Deuteronomy 11:24. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. Your border will be from the wilderness, that's the Negev in the south, to Lebanon, that's the forest in the north, right around Mount Hermon, and from the river Euphrates, that's to the east, right there as you approach Syria. As far as the western sea, that's the Mediterranean. So that's just a quick geographical way of saying from the north to the south, to the east to the west, it's all yours. Go take it. It's interesting to me that the Jews extend this promise to beyond the Promised Land. They say every place in which the sole of your foot treads, well, that would include the diaspora, wherever they're Jews. Some of them say this. It would include all enemies conquered outside of Canaan. And as I said, some rabbis even include lands into which Jews are exiled. Now, when I hear that, this is from John Gill, who knows the rabbis up and down. It amazes me how many groups of people in this world like to claim the whole planet for themselves. Remember, Islam says they're going to take over the whole world. That's their belief. The communists did the same thing, the secular religionists. It's all ours. The whole world's going to be ours. Now, even the rabbis are saying that. Well, that's nonsense. The limits are fixed. In fact, we see the limits of the land that Joshua has promised to the Jews. Joshua 1:4, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, that's from the south. The wilderness is the Negev in the south, the desert. And this Lebanon in the north, even as far as the great river, that's the Euphrates, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, as far as the great sea. The Hittites were that empire that covered present-day Turkey, and they kind of reached on out down on the border between Turkey and present-day Syria. So when you're talking about the river Euphrates, you're talking about at the edge of Syria, and so that's the land of the Hittites. As far as the Great Sea toward the setting of the sun, that, of course, is the Mediterranean in the west. All of that will be your territory. And that, of course, is in the next verse in Joshua 1. So it's every place limited by the boundaries which I'm about to give you. And the limits were also fixed not only to Joshua but also to Moses, because he in Deuteronomy 34, when he's looking over the Promised Land from the top of Mount Pisgah / Nebo. We'll look at that. Now, Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah. I'm assuming Nebo and Pisgah are the same place. Scholars disagree. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan. That's looking up the east side of the Jordan River all the way to the northernmost tribe of Dan, and then all Naphtali, which is to the west of Lake Hula and the Sea of Galilee, in the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, that's in the center of Israel, and all the land of Judah, that's in the south, as far as the western sea, west until you hit the Mediterranean, and the Negev, which God called the wilderness when he was talking to Joshua, And the plain in the valley of Jericho. So now we go back up and look in the Araba Valley. Jericho is in the Jordan River Valley, the Araba Valley, a little bit to the north. And then we go all the way down to the south of the Dead Sea is Zoar. So basically the boundaries are the same. A little more details given to Moses. But it's very clear what land the Lord gave to the Israelites. It wasn't the whole world. Now, of course, the antitype of Israel, the new Israel, the church, will rule the whole world, but that's a rule of righteousness, kingdom, and righteousness, peace, and joy, the kingdom of Christ. It is not a political rule. Now, God, in speaking to Joshua here, says, I'm doing all this just as I spoke to Moses. Well, when did God speak to Moses? Well, that would be that verse I just read, Deuteronomy 34, verses 1 through 4. Now, when had God spoken to Moses? That was about 30 days earlier, before Moses' death and mourning period. So God takes up the story here and encourages Joshua just right after Moses had died, about a month or so. We go down to verse 4, and I just read verse 4 to you, which describes the limits of the promised land, from the Lebanon in the north to the wilderness, the Negev in the south, to the Euphrates River, where the Euphrates River kind of bends in Syria, instead of going northeast, mainly it starts going instead of going northwest, it bends and goes almost due west right there, right past Golan, right past Bashan. And then the land goes from there, the Euphrates, to the Great Sea, the Mediterranean. Now, I briefly mentioned the Hittites. Let me give you a more scholarly definition of the Hittites. Back in the second millennium BC, they had a whole empire, the capital city of which is in Cappadocia in eastern Turkey, I can't ever remember how to pronounce that. I'd like to go see it. I think tourists can go see it even to this day. And there are Hittite monuments all over Turkey. And the Hittites, as I said, extended a little bit beyond Turkey over toward the area of Syria. In fact, there were a lot of Hittites that ended up by the time of David, after the empire had kind of collapsed, there were still Hittites in the land of Israel. So they were not just one of the Ites of Canaan. They were important people. Here's what Easton says, quote, the Hittites, who were the warlike element of this confederation of tribes, they inhabited the whole region between the Euphrates and Damascus, their chief cities being Carchemish on the Euphrates and Kadesh. These are two famous cities in ancient history. In the Orontes Valley, Kadesh was in the Orontes, Carchemish on the Euphrates. The Orontes, of course, is that river between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon Range in present-day Lebanon. So this is where Hittites were, about 6 miles south of the Lake of Homs. You've heard of Homs, Syria. These Hittites seem to have risen to great power as a nation, for a long time they were formidable rivals of the Egyptian and Assyrian empires. In the book of Joshua, they always appear as the dominant race to the north of Galilee. All right, so this north, east, south, and west description of Israel in Joshua 1:4, when did the occupation of this land take place, the full occupation of it? We read in 2 Samuel 8:3. Then David defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, those Assyrian kingdoms up there in that area between around Damascus. David defeated these Syrian kings as he went to restore his rule at the river. Restore his rule, David's rule at the river. So David's kingdom went all the way to the Euphrates River. And we can read in 1 Kings 4:21 about Solomon's rule. Now, Solomon, of course, is David's son. Now, Solomon ruled all over all the kingdoms from the river, that's the Euphrates River, to the land of the Philistines, that's on the southwest border of Israel on the Mediterranean coast, and to the border of Egypt, that's the Wadi El Arish, way down to the south of Israel. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. We also read in 2 Chronicles 9:26, he, referring to Solomon, was the ruler over all the kings from the Euphrates River, even to the land of the Philistines and as far as the border of Egypt. So, ladies and gentlemen, this prophecy of God to Joshua was fulfilled. The Israelites got their land, just as was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of theological implications of this, because a lot of people say that the Israelites never got their land, and it's been fulfilled in 1948 in that present-day geopolitical nation of Israel, which is one of my favorite countries. It's the only democracy in the Middle East. I've visited there. I love the place. But I do not think that the land of Israel in 1948 fulfilled the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were fulfilled by the time of David and Solomon. And the scripture clearly says that. So you probably ought to put an asterisk by 2 Samuel 8:3, 1 Kings 4:21, and 2 Chronicles 9:26. When a dispensationalist comes to you and starts talking about 1948, say, no, it's already been fulfilled. Ah, but it might be a double fulfillment. Yeah, could be a triple fulfillment. I could speculate that in the year 2200, there's going to be another land of Israel. Once you start getting into double fulfillment, you're into the realm of speculation about the future, and I can't argue that, so you can't establish it, and I can't refute it, so you can speculate all you want. But I know one thing, that the promise of the promised land was fulfilled already, as defined by these boundaries in Joshua 1:4. We go now to Joshua 1, verses 5 through 7. Well, first of all, before I go any further, notice that in verse 4, the Mediterranean is called the Great Sea. Why is it called the Great Sea? It's a simple reason. The Mediterranean is bigger. The Mediterranean Sea is bigger than the Sea of Tiberias, the Sea of Galilee, and the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea. The biggest one they had back then, the Jews, so they called it the Great Sea. We now go to Joshua 1, verses 5 through 7. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life, God continues to say to Joshua. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. Now, when God tells Joshua that no man will be able to stand before Joshua, that promise was also given to the people in general in Deuteronomy 11:25. No man will be able to stand before you. The Lord your God will lay the dread of you and the fear of you on all the land on which you set foot, as he has spoken to you. So this is a Newt Rockne win one for the Gipper type speech. Moses had encouraged the people after he told them what a bunch of jerks they were. I still can't get over that. But then he says, hey, obey the law, you'll live, choose life, cross the Jordan, you'll win. And so God is telling Joshua the same thing. He says, be strong. Now, actually, in Deuteronomy 31:6, Moses had also told Joshua to be strong. Be strong and courageous. Don't be terrified or afraid of them, the Canaanites, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Notice in verse 7, God repeats his exhortation to be strong, except this time he says, be strong and very courageous. Not just courageous, but very courageous. Now, someone has said, I don't have the quote, unfortunately, but he says this, quote, for though Joshua was a man of valor and courage, as appears by his war with Amalek, that's when Joshua, at Rephidim, right before they got to Mount Sinai, they fought that battle, and Moses had to hold his hands up in the air with a staff so Joshua could win. And, of course, that took a lot of guts. So Joshua was a man of valor and courage, yet there was need of this exhortation and of repeating it. Be strong and courageous, since he was to engage with a people more and mightier than those with him, and who dwelt in strong and fortified places, and had been preparing for some time, having had notice and were in expectation of the Israelites' attempt upon them. In other words, this wasn't going to be a walk in the park, this conquest of Canaan. Now, Jameson Foss and Brown point out, it might have been very easy to assume the conquest would be easy. After all, had not God granted them the land, and therefore there it is. Ah, good type here. I was talking to a young woman in China who was looking for a husband. She was 33 years old, and that's the kiss of death if you're a Chinese woman and not married yet. And she was having trouble. There was one person that I was encouraging her to go sort of lay her trap for, you know, to fish for. And she says, why can't God just send me a husband? I said, well, you know, if you're hungry and you need to eat a fish, you got to put a bait and a hook in the water. And likewise, that just shows that God will promise you a lot of stuff, but that doesn't mean it's going to be easy for that promise to be effected in your life. Sometimes you got to do some tough stuff, some hard stuff. Now notice God tells Joshua in verse 7, after he tells Joshua to be strong and very courageous, be careful to do according to all the law. And there we go again. Obey, 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 obey the law. Now this wasn't just an exhortation to do privately what the law commanded, an exhortation to Joshua. Joshua, remember, was the supreme magistrate of the people. He was the chief justice. So his obedience had much broader implications than would an ordinary person. And that's why it's so terrible when a judge in the judicial system takes a bribe or something like it in modern day times, because that's not just corruption on a private scale. You're corrupting the whole public system of justice. So Joshua really had to obey the law. He was the leader. He was the example. Now in verse 7, God promises Joshua success. You obey the law that you may have success wherever you go. Now, of course, this verse has been used to talk about financial success and to say that the verse promises financial success, especially with the next verse, Joshua 1:8. Having been around the name it and claim it people back 50 years ago, I know all about Joshua 1:8, so I'll talk about that when we get there. Let's go there now, Joshua 1, verses 8 and 9. This book of the law, God continues to talk to Joshua, shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Now the book of the law, remember there was a copy laid up in the sanctuary that was in the Ark of the Covenant. And remember back in the latter chapters of Deuteronomy that the Israelites made a copy of the law and they put it beside the altar. And some people say it was inside the Ark of the Covenant. And some people say it was beside the Ark of the Covenant. I didn't mean to say the altar. I'm sorry, the Ark of the Covenant. And so there was a copy and they say that that copy was used for reference so people could look at it. The judges could look at it when they needed to without going into the Ark and messing with the stone tables. And of course, this would be a full copy of the law too. So this law, all the words of God, shall not depart from your mouth, Joshua. What does that mean, not depart from your mouth? That means, Joshua, you frequently repeat the law itself, or Joshua, you frequently speak about the law, you comment on the law, and you cite the law, which, of course, is what lawyers and judges do today. Keep it in your mouth. Don't ever let it go away from you. Meditate on it day and night, and that just means all the time. It doesn't mean 24 hours every second of the day and night, but it just means frequently, all the time. If you do that, and then you're not only supposed to talk about it, you're also supposed to be careful to do according to all that is written in it. So it's not just talk, it's also walk. Now notice in verse 9 that God tells Joshua for the third time, be strong and courageous, do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you. So this was again was going to be a very difficult task that Joshua had set before him. Now let me go back to this idea I said about Joshua 1:8 being used by the hyper faith people, the name it and claim it, blab it and grab it, confess it and possess it, scream it and redeem it, mark it and park it, hung by the tongue, folks, the most heinous heresy we've seen in a long time in the church. Well, these people will always say, you do the law, you keep God's law, and he will make your way prosperous. Now, that's a half-truth. For one thing, prosperous does not just necessarily mean financial prosperity. Here, in the context, it was talking about military victory. It just means success. So it might mean success with your in-laws, success in your relationships, success with your boss, success in doing what you want to do even though you're not making a lot of money at it. It just means success. So that's point number one. And point number two, this is a general statement. To put some nuance on it, it's a general statement that's true generally. People that obey God's laws are prosperous. Look at the Jews. They obey God's law. And many of them are prosperous. I grew up in a town that had heavy Jewish influence. It's supposed to be one of the most tolerant towns in America toward Jewish people. I found out later in my adult life. And I thought about it and said, yeah, almost every Jew I know in my hometown is prosperous. I practiced law, and there were a lot of lawyers that were Jewish and a lot of businessmen that were Jewish in my hometown. And there's nothing wrong with that. And so when faith people say that you'll be prosperous if you obey the law, in generally, they're right. They are right. They're correct. But Paul the Apostle, he obeyed the law of Christ, and sometimes he was sitting out there in the wilderness with no money. Now, of course, God always supplied his needs, and God took care of him. So prosperous might mean having it just when you need it, not because you've got it all stored up in a bank account, but you have the money you need when you need it, as well as other things, other aspects of success that you need. And again, in denouncing the hyper-faith message and the and cash flow dollar and all these TV evangelists who are telling you to send your money to them so they can get rich, in denouncing them, we don't need to go to the other extreme and say that the gospel is a gospel of poverty. No, God hates poverty. Poverty is a terrible thing. That's why I believe in capitalism. I believe that the free market ought to spread all over the world because that's what brings people out of poverty. But now we've got a bunch of moronic socialists telling us exactly the opposite, and they're going to bring the world into a lot of poverty, and it's going to be sad. Poverty is a bad thing. We go down to Joshua 1, verses 10 and 11. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, "Pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, saying, prepare for provisions for yourselves. For within 3 days you are to cross this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it." Now, what officers is Joshua talking to? That's probably judicial officers or military officers. Or maybe the officers are combined. Maybe the military people were also legal officials too. That's kind of the way they did things back then. And this camp that they're passing through, remember, there's over 600,000 fighting men in the camp. In the two censuses, the first census, I don't remember the exact number, about 603,000. The second census, I think it had declined a little bit. But we're talking about over 600,000 people they have to go through and get ready to invade. So this is a big deal. And they had 3 days to get ready. Now, what provisions did they have to prepare? Well, remember, they already had manna. John Gill says this about that. "Rather, this designs meat and other provisions, which being upon the borders of Moab and Midian, they could furnish themselves with for their money." In other words, they just conquered Sihon, the Amorite, who had conquered the land of Moab, and the Midianites were mixed therein with the Moabites, as we've already seen at the end of Deuteronomy. So we got several nations or tribes there that would be glad to sell them stuff for money so they could buy meat. "They were in the possession of a fine country of Bashan and Gilead," going north up the Jordan River, "and then east toward Bashan." That's a very fertile country. "They had taken Sihon and Og." Sihon is at Heshbon in Moab, and Og is up in Bashan. They had all that land, and they could get cattle and meat from there. Now, they had manna, as we said, but manna only lasts for 1 day. And I suspect, in fact, I know, I can't quote the scripture right now, but I know that the manna stopped when they crossed the Jordan River, so that's going to be gone. So they had to get meat. And, of course, they could have used livestock, farm animals, from the conquered countries, either that they took as booty in the battle or that they're buying from them. Or they could go out and hunt wild animals, deer and such, but they had to get ready. Now, the 3 days, there's a little bit of a reconciliation problem. It's mentioned afterwards that Joshua sent the spies out, and the spies spent 3 days in the mountains, in addition to the time spent by the spies in going and coming to the mountains. So if the spies were sent out after this three-day provisioning, if the spies were sent out after this, Israel could not have left within 3 days, and yet it says here they're going to leave within 3 days. So the only way to reconcile that is that the spies went into Canaan before this, spent some time looking around, 3 days looking around in the mountains to see what's ahead of them, and then they came back, and then they spent three more days getting ready to go. So later on, when we get there, it's mentioned that Joshua sent the spies out. Those spies had already been sent out. The mention of the spies came later than this, but the going out of the spies happened before this. We go now to Joshua 1, verses 12 and 13. "To the Reubenites and to the Gadites and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God gives you rest, and he will give you this land." Now, the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, that's the 2.5 tribes on the east side of the Jordan in the Transjordan area. Of course, that's where Israel is now, in the Transjordan area. And the reason Joshua is reminding them is because they had made a promise to Moses, look, if you'll let us stay here on the east side of the Jordan, we will go with you to help conquer the promised land. And then after we beat those nasty Canaanites, we'll come back over the Jordan River and come back to the east. We see that in Numbers 32, verses 29 and 30. Moses said to them, if the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, everyone who is armed for battle, will cross with you over the Jordan in the presence of the Lord, and the land is subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. So Moses tells the other Israelites, hey, this is the deal. If they cross over and fight with you, we'll give them Gilead, which is the Transjordan area. But if they will not cross over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. There's your choice. Well, they chose Transjordan area, but they had to go fight in the west across the Jordan River in order to get it. Now Moses says, remember, Reubenites, Gadites, and half Manasseh, the Lord your God gives you rest. This is the type of rest the believer receives in the kingdom of God. This famous passage in Hebrews 4:1. And in verses 3 through 11, I'm going to read this through and emphasize the Old Testament references. Therefore, let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. For we who have believed enter that rest, just as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. That seems a little contradictory. God swore that they will not enter into his rest. What he's saying is, the rest is the state of salvation in Jesus. That's what the rest is. The author of Hebrews is saying this is the antitype, in other words. The rest is the antitype. Not entering into the rest is not the antitype, but the rest is the antitype. Verse 4, Hebrews 4, for he has said somewhere concerning the seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage, they shall not enter my rest. Therefore, since it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day today, saying through David, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. So this is all from the book of Hebrews. And I'm not going to go into a detailed exposition of that. I've already done that in my podcast on Hebrews 4. But I just want to emphasize here how this is referring to the rest. And that comes from this Old Testament passage, not just this one, but other Old Testament passages that refer to entering into the land of Canaan as a rest. And that is a type of the antitype of Christians entering into salvation. And in fact, the author of Hebrews mentions Joshua in Hebrews 4:8. If Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. If he had given them rest, he did not give them complete rest when they conquered the land. So we move now to Joshua 1, verses 14 and 15. Your wives, your little ones, and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. Joshua is still talking to the 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh. So I say half Manasseh because half of the tribe of Manasseh stayed on the east side, and the other half took land on the west side. So Joshua continues to talking to these 2.5 tribes. Your little ones and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. That's the Transjordan area to the east of the Jordan River. But you shall cross before your brothers in battle array, all your valiant warriors, and shall help them until the Lord gives your brothers rest, as he gives you, and they also possess the land which the Lord your God is giving them. Then you shall return to your own land and possess that which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise, in other words, to the east of the Jordan. Now the 2.5 tribes are said to muster with the rest of the troops in battle array. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that means officered or marshaled under 5 leaders in the old and approved caravan order. Remember, they marched through the wilderness in military order, as we saw in the book of Numbers. Exodus 13:18 says this, hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea, and the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. So you see, leaving Egypt, they marched in martial array. John Gill says, quote, in a military order, in rank and file, by fives, 5 in a row, not at the front of the army, for the standard of Judah went first, but along with them, for before them signifies no other than in the presence of them and in company with them. Well, that's getting pretty technical, Mr. Gill. But the point is they're ready for battle. These 2.5 tribes are. Now, Joshua tells these 2.5 tribes that all your valiant warriors, quotation mark, A-L-L, close quote, all your valiant warriors shall help. Well, actually, as John Gill points out, Joshua did not take all of the 2.5 tribes' soldiers, only a select company of strong and valiant, for out of 130,000, but 40,000 went with him. We see that in Joshua chapter 4, verse 13. About 40,000 equipped for war crossed for battle before the Lord to the desert plains of Jericho. And that left a whole bunch behind. Adam Clark does some calculation, and I'm not going to get into his calculation, but he says that there were 70,580 effective men were left behind in the east to guard the 2.5 tribes and their property. So what does all mean here? Well, to me, I just read it this way. All of the valiant warriors who went, not all of the warriors available for battle, but all your valiant warriors who are going to be in battle array. That's the easiest way, in my opinion, to handle that. But also, all often just means many, if you look in the lexicons. So you would read it this way: "You shall cross before your brothers in battle array very many of your valiant warriors." Not a problem there. We go now to verse 16 of Joshua 1 through verse 18. "They answered Joshua," this is the 2.5 tribes, "saying, 'All that you have commanded us we will do, and wherever you send us we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey your words and all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous.'" Note that now the 2.5 tribes are encouraging Joshua in the same way that God had previously done. The 2.5 tribes say to Joshua, "Be strong and courageous." Joshua got a lot of encouragement here. Now, when it says in verse 16, "They answered Joshua," the context shows that that's the 2.5 tribes, and saying, "Hey, everything you've commanded us, we will do. We'll go over to fight the Canaanites on the west side of the Jordan River. Wherever you send us, we'll go. We'll go over the Jordan River. Whatever city you want us to besiege, we'll besiege it." But then in verse 17, they say, "Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, we'll obey you." Now, really? If the 2.5 tribes were just like all the rest of the Israelites, they disobeyed Moses at every possible occasion. So the words seem a little self-serving to me. But notice the general tone of optimism here. The atmosphere is one of success. We're going to win this thing. Adam Clark says this, quote, "Is it not strange that at the death of Moses, utter despair had not overwhelmed the whole camp, as he whom they expected to give them rest had died before any conquest was made in Canaan? We find, however, that they are not discouraged. He who gave them Moses has now given them Joshua in his place, and they had now fully learned that if God be for them, none could be successfully against them." Clark continues in another place to say, quote, "When God has a great work to accomplish, he will provide himself suitable instruments, and though one which he has greatly honored appear to fail, we should know that he is not confined to work but that one alone." Great application point there. When the people of God need a leader, God will provide a leader. And I'm going to tell you something, folks, the evangelical church in America today, oh boy, do we need a leader, because we don't have one. And the church is floundering and being overwhelmed by the culture, and we need a revival of the Holy Spirit so bad, because our culture is so antichrist now. It is something that I've never experienced before in my 70 years of living in this country. Well, this is sort of encouraging to see here. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how bad things look. Be strong and courageous. Go over there and take the promised land. That would probably preach somewhere. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the first chapter of Joshua 1. That prepares us now to go to chapter 2. In Joshua 2, we will examine the story of how Rahab hid the spies, that famous story. Was she a prostitute? Was she not a prostitute? She's written up in the Faith Hall of Fame. How can a prostitute be in the Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews 11 and so forth? So we should enjoy that. That's our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that one, and I hope you enjoyed this one.